The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. This week, we hear how the Prime Minister's personal pledge to open up parliamentary debate is expected to be watered down. And following on from the story in last week's podcast that Adobe is to stop developing Flash for mobile browsers, we hear how a group of developers are moving on to the next stage in the battle with the browser plugin and are encouraging people to stop using it altogether. Plus, there are the details on Google's launch of their new music service, but spoiler alert, it's only US for now. More on that later. Now, I'm joined by The Guardian's telecoms correspondent, Juliet Garside, and Occupy London's Martin Diddis. Welcome. Okay, so before we start, I don't know if either of you have seen this story, but the Pakistan Telecommunications Authority have created a list of 1,500 words that are deemed offensive. And they've actually instructed mobile operators to stop messages from being sent. Now, obviously, the list includes the usual suspects, which I won't say here, just in case, you know, the SWAT team comes down on us. But it also includes things like flatulence, deposit, and fondle. So, Martin, are there any words that you would like to have banned from your mobile?
I wouldn't ban any word, but I want to see that list.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. Can you imagine window dressing? You know, some kind of. What about you, Juliet?
Well, I've just been writing about two very misused words this morning, particularly when it comes to marketing: free and unlimited. Used very often in connection with broadband, and very rarely meaning what they say.
Ah, duplicitous. I like that. Well, mine would definitely be inbox is full. Well, we have more highbrow technology stories just like this coming up over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The mobile music battleground just got that bit more complicated in the last 7 days with the launch of Google Music, the search company's answer to iTunes for their Android devices. Google has managed to sign up all but one of the major labels, Warner's The Outcast, and at present it's restricted to the US only. Though, like most of their other services, that's likely to change. The service launched with some exclusive content from the Rolling Stones, Coldplay, Busta Rhymes, and Pearl Jam. And the MP3 files are priced the same as tracks from Apple's iTunes. Not to be outdone, though, Apple released its own cloud service last week. iTunes Match will place the music that you have in iTunes on your device into the cloud without having to upload the individual files. Google's service could involve many hours of uploading your back catalog. The other way it differs from Apple's iTunes Match is that Google will offer free cloud storage space for 20,000 songs, and they're tying the service in with Google Plus. Once you buy a track, any of your friends can listen to it once for free on their social network. So, Martin, are any of the selling points, things like exclusive content, Google Plus integration, the cloud storage, are they good enough to make this a winner in your view?
I think it's mostly interesting to people on Android phones because it gives them a music store on their phone, which they haven't had before. People with Macs, with iPhones, I'm not sure if they'll be interested.
Juliet, would you switch? I mean, it doesn't have to be an exclusive thing. You can use one or you can use the other. But, you know, is this something that will allow Google to rise above the rest battle to music dominance?
Yeah, storage is attractive. It's free. 20,000 songs is quite a lot. You'd have to pay for that on Apple. But what makes it really clever and raises huge consumer issues, I think, is switching. It's going to be tough. Once you've uploaded 20,000, 120,000 songs, are you going to want to move to another service with all the faff that involves? Plus, you know, you've probably got an Android mobile and you're using Android on your tablet, so you have to change all your screens, not just the one. I think companies like Apple, Google, Sony's interested, are going to use these kind of storage services to put, as someone expressed it the other day, put their customers in jail. And make it very hard for them to leave. And also, it's, you know, you've got to have it, everyone else has.
Well, Martin, your background is as a software developer for Last FM. Mm. Now, that system is very different. What can you tell me that would benefit Google in terms of how they provide their service? You know, things like streaming music service, or you know, this global reach. It's only in the US at the moment, but they do intend to go international.
Well, I think from that perspective, at the moment, music online is quite interesting in that Google, of course, is US only. But what I've seen up close over the last couple of years is how complex music licensing is. It's one of those remaining areas where you want to provide global services but need to deal with territorial licensing, and it's incredibly challenging. It's a music industry in sort of some people say it's in its last throes. It's not easy to run such a service, and it's only possible to a couple of large companies like Google, like Apple, now Spotify. Only a few people and only a few companies can figure out how to do that. It's a very closed space. It's a very crazy, very weird space for me. To me,
it's interesting though how they are trying to integrate with things like Google Plus. I mean, is this just a very expensive advertising campaign for their social network? You know, what effect do you think this might have on the uptake of Google Plus, Martin?
Well, yeah, it's a bootstrapping mechanism. It's a way to get people to tell their friends that there's this service now. And I'm sure that gives them a certain amount of reach. But yeah, well, let's see how it plays out.
What do you think about this in comparison with something like Ping, you know, which is the iTunes version of what Google is trying to do by integrating with Google Plus, their social network?
Yeah, Google Plus hasn't been a huge success so far. People are quite comfortable with Facebook and Twitter, and they're not really looking for like a third social network just yet. whether this will create it, I don't know. I think storage is going to be a really big issue, and possibly actually a potential revenue model for record labels. There is something compelling about popping all your music onto someone's server and then not having to worry about how you access it in future. And and if you're paying to store it, I mean, 20,000 free storage for 20,000 songs for free isn't going to be a revenue share model, but Apple's might be. They charge up to £70 for iCloud storage, for the largest bracket of iCloud storage. So, you know, people aren't prepared to buy songs up front or pay much to do that. They might be prepared to pay to store them.
Martin?
Yeah, it's actually interesting that you bring up Ping, because it's an excellent example of the fact that even though you're big and you have incredible power over a market, your model might not work. I don't think anybody's using Ping, and which might have a number of reasons. I don't think people necessarily are interested in when their friends bought something as much as what their preferences are, what they've been listening to. But in the end, I don't know what the reasons are. Ping doesn't work.
Well, my problem with things like Ping and Google Plus is that you can't block people, but that's a whole other story. Also this week, it's been claimed that a pledge by the Prime Minister David Cameron to influence the choice of topics for parliamentary debate is to be watered down. Although part of their technology promise during the 2010 election campaign was to bring e-petition debates into the Commons, it's believed that ministers have discussed raising the number of signatures from 100,000 to 150,000 before an issue is considered for inclusion in policy discussion agendas. Some debates have been moved away from the main chamber of the House of Commons as well to the lower profile Westminster Hall, where they're not put to a vote. One of the explanations has been that some of the Prime Minister's problems have been exacerbated by e-petitions. So politically speaking, not necessarily a good thing to get everything that people want in front of the House. But Martin, what effect do you think that this decision will actually have on the public's perception of e-participation with government, given, you know, how involved you are with Occupy London and your awareness of how involved the man on the street, the woman on the street are with, you know, protest, with participating in government?
So it raises two questions. The first is, as you say, what is the perception of these tools and these changes? And the second is, what is the actual effect? When it comes to actual effect, I think in terms of making in terms of political decision making, they're quite limited. A successful petition gives you a discussion, but not a commitment to any change. So in the end, it's a tool to spread information. It's maybe you could see it as a marketing tool, and in that sense, it is quite important because it allows people to connect over political political debates. It allows people to find a starting point to start conversations. But that will happen regardless of what the limits are. I think that will still take place.
And to what degree, though, do you think people on the street are going to be affected by this decision? I mean, are they going to suddenly raise arms?
Yeah. Not at all.
I mean, it's interesting. Do you think, Juliet, that perhaps the motivation beyond the political motivation, you know, the sort of the burying the bad news potentially, allegedly, in the rumor mill, do you think that perhaps there were just too many petitions that hit the 100,000 threshold and they suddenly went, oh, we can't actually discuss all of these?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's worked, so they're stopping it. It's worked because it's influenced the content of parliamentary debates with serious topics. Think, you know, not crazy things about everyone's now a Jedi Knight, like the census answers that people were campaigning for a few years ago.
And but, successfully did as well.
Yeah. But these, you know, the topics chosen, I think because they go through a backbench filtering system, have been really valid. So, you know, we've had debates on the control of immigration, saying we need financial education as part of the school curriculum. Slightly sillier ones like, you know, looters should lose their benefits have been shunted to Westminster Hall where MPs don't have to vote. But, yeah, essentially they've worked. And although, and Europe has been the other topic, the European referendum, and although people haven't managed to change government policy, they've created a need for whips to go around making compromises and deals to get votes through. That is how politics works. It's not, you know, click your fingers and it happens. It's a slow tussle of negotiation. And these have had an effect.
It's interesting, participatory hacks, isn't it? Ultimately, you know, it's somebody throwing a hack into the mix and saying, right, government, talk about, you know, looters should lose their benefits, talk about the immigration. And that engagement is something, Martin, would you say, has really evolved because of the communication technologies? In some ways, it's undermined the hierarchies that we've seen. It's made the communication more porous, perhaps, between the citizen and the government.
I think it's just an early starting point in trying to figure out how can we have individuals participate in the political decision-making process. I think it's sort of, it's just an early hint. It's just a glimpse of what's possible. I only see it as a starting point.
And I'm sure we'll hear more about that later in our next discussion item. But before then, finally in this week's news, following on from the story in our last program that Adobe is dropping support for the Flash plugin on mobile devices, a group of developers have come together to protest for the complete removal of the media player from all machines and move towards HTML5. The group, who have called themselves Occupy Flash as a nod to the worldwide protest movement, have published their manifesto at occupyflash.org. Its kernel is the following. Flash makes the web less accessible. At this point, it's holding back the web. I think that's pretty heavy-duty levying against Flash. So Tech Weekly wanted to find out more, and we asked the anonymous folks behind this movement if they could explain a little bit about their motivation for their protest and why they came together.
About a week ago, a little bit more than a week ago now, Adobe made an announcement that they were going to be dropping support for mobile devices with their Flash platform. At the same time, they also announced that they would be continuing to support Flash on the browser, and in fact, they felt that it was as relevant as ever, apparently, on browsers. And a group of us, and we're all web developers or in the web development community, saw that as kind of a roadmap, if you will, that Adobe had laid out that would create effectively two very different experiences on the web. So you have the experience that you would get on a mobile browser or a tablet browser, and then you have this different experience that you're going to get on a desktop browser. And That didn't seem like it was in the interest of anybody except for Adobe. It definitely didn't seem to us like it was in the interest of people who are actually browsing the web. Why have something that's going to be one way when you're sitting in front of your laptop and a totally different way when you try to go show that same thing to your buddy when you're using your iPhone or your Android phone or something like that. Occupy Flash is comprised of a number of developers. We're web developers, we're web designers in the mobile and web development community. Started off with a bunch of us on the West Coast actually chatting on Facebook about this stuff. And we decided we wanted to start a conversation about this, and we wanted to get people talking about it and talking about the idea that we could live in a world where the Flash plugin was no longer part of the desktop browsing experience. At this point, we are actually spread out all around the world. We've had quite a substantial number of people come forward and volunteer over the last week to do translation of the site and to handle media requests in their various different languages and that kind of thing. We decided when we started this thing out that we wanted to do this anonymously. The most prominent reason is that we just didn't want this to be about us. So there's a sort of tendency in the web industry to kind of do everything you can to promote yourself. And that's not really what we were thinking when we wanted to start this. What we wanted to do is to get people talking and to get people thinking. And we didn't want people talking and thinking about us or what our motivations were. We wanted people talking and thinking about the web and what the web could be like if we get Flash out of the market. And so that's why we decided to become anonymous. What we hope to achieve, obviously, is to get people to uninstall the Flash player. That's a pretty lofty goal. I mean, the Flash player is installed on 99%, I think, of the world's desktop browsers. That number, by the way, the irony is not lost on us with the name of our movement. And realistically, I don't think that we're going to get all the people in the world to uninstall the Flash player, but what we have been able to do is to get people talking about it. And so that was really what we were hoping to achieve. It's been argued that even if we get to abandon Flash, that proprietary software will still be part of the web, and I think that's probably true. I mean, it's going to take a long time to get all of this entrenched proprietary software out of the web, but we are making progress, and I think that as long as we can keep on moving forward and moving in that direction, we'll eventually get there. You know, there will always be some part of the web that's proprietary, but the more that we can reduce that, I think the better it is for the people who are actually using this. There is the choice not to install Flash, whereas some people have said, well, you don't have the choice not to use HTML5. I don't think we really see that as a valid argument, and primarily for the reason that we don't really see HTML5 as being the antithesis of Flash. HTML5 definitely has some of the functionality of Flash, but it's not like we're saying you should stop using Flash and start using HTML5, although, you know, we think that you should use HTML5 solutions where you can. Really what we're saying is that we need to get proprietary plugins out of the web. One of the ways that we're doing that is by adopting HTML5 and browsers that support HTML5 and sites that use HTML5 to replace functionality of Flash where available. There are honestly some parts of Flash that don't have a replacement in HTML5 yet, but they're probably not ever going to unless we can get Flash out of the market.
One of the Occupy Flash protesters. There's more on this and the rest of the week's news as it unfolds at guardian.co.uk/technology. Occupy is a global movement, connecting those communities around the world who wish to say something under a common banner. Its virtuality, some might argue, is very much the essence of the web. Martin Dittes is a German engineer whose background is as a software developer at Last.fm. Now as a free agent, he's taken his trade to the streets and helps to organize the technology used by London-based protesters to connect with each other and the world. Martin, what is the technology that's being used on the ground?
So the first thing we should say is that it's not a homogeneous culture. It's a community of communities. And every little subgroup or every group of people that interacts might use very different tools. Communication technology is incredibly important. On the ground, obviously, we use phones, we use radios. But it's very interesting to look at online communication as well. One thing that I really liked was that people online who weren't able to visit the various occupation sites started setting up their own general assembly. The general assembly is the decision-making body of the occupation, and they meet on TeamSpeak, which is an audio. It's a form of Skype, which comes out of the games community, and it was a technology that they were familiar with. They showed others how to use it, and then every evening at 9 they have their online general assembly. PiratePad is incredibly useful. We write our press releases with PiratePad. It's an online collaborative text editor, so you can several people can edit the same text, and you can see the changes that other people make as they happen. So when we make press releases or when we write other documents, sometimes it's quite important that multiple people participate in that process, that is not an individual writing on it. The biggest challenge is to get all these little subgroups to coordinate. And that's a problem that's there by design. Everybody feels strongly that we don't want to build hierarchies, we want to build networks of independent agents that interact with each other. And having them figure out what everybody else is doing and what the important things are that are happening right now, that is quite a challenge, but it's a challenge that we set ourselves. It's a challenge that comes out of this desire to be networked and not hierarchical. It's massively multimodal communication. Everybody uses quite different tools, sometimes out of necessity, but it's also a virtue because it forces us to figure out processes to bridge those gaps.
You mention this notion of network, and this reminds me of something that you wrote for The Guardian for Comment is Free not long ago, and you mentioned Manuel Castells, who is he's a researcher, he's a thinker about things like the network society. To what extent in the coordination and the team organizing that you do at Occupy London are you implicating Manuel's work?
Well, I think he offers a very good model that allows us to verbalize what it is that we're doing, to understand what we're doing. If a lot of the interaction between individual groups depends on the initiative of individual people, as part of this networked structure, you get to meet a lot of people, and it's necessary to know a lot of people. Who you know determines what you can do, what you have access to. So in getting familiar with the organization and how things are running, you inevitably start connecting to people. And that is very much a networking activity, because it's not about individuals in central locations, but instead a very heterogeneous network of people. It makes for a very resilient organizational structure.
Well, also a diffuse message. The notion of a centralized structure, even the idea of having a general assembly who communicates perhaps remotely or communicates amongst themselves, still has to fall under a particular banner. How are you coordinating that with the technology?
The internet communities that have prospered in the last 10 years, be it music communities like Last.fm, be it news networks where it's a crowd that identifies interesting topics of the day. There are so many examples where we can see new forms of organization that also create a desire for participation, which I think is new. So in that respect, technology ends up being a starting point. I'm a strong believer in the transformative power of the internet. And I think when it comes to the technology of the internet, we probably pretty much have seen what it's going to be. But what we haven't seen yet is the implications of having that technology. I think when it comes to that, we're only at the beginning.
What is the transformative power outside the two most often referenced, which are communication and connectivity, organizational capacity? What else is it? I mean, how is that any different from other communication technologies that have come before?
I like that you bring up those two, because to me it is about those two, and it is exactly in those two that where we haven't seen it play out yet. In the last 10 years, we've seen a crisis in the music industry, in the film industry, so in sort of intellectual property regimes. At the moment, we are seeing a crisis in the publishing industry, all caused by the presence of the internet. I think it's inevitable that at some point we will see a similar crisis in governance models, where the notion of a nation state clashes with a new desire to be connected and to participate in things that are important to you, things that impact your life.
I wonder to what extent there may emerge a hierarchy due to the idea of the people on the ground, a core of sort of physically present individuals, and then the remote individuals who some in the past have described at other protests and for other participation models as armchair activists, people who simply press like Occupy London on Facebook or other technologies. Can you envisage a hierarchy that emerging out of that, or how do you coordinate and integrate the communications, the needs, the desires, the decisions made by this enormous network?
I don't see that as a hierarchy. I see that as people in different situations having different abilities because of their situation. One of the biggest opportunities for us is to figure out or to improve the way in which we integrate volunteers, in which we introduce them to the organization and to the degree to which we're able to give them tasks to get them started. And online communities and their ability to rally volunteers, but also to spread information, are so much more powerful. So I don't see the hierarchy that you're describing. I again see a network of organizations that need to figure out how to coordinate.
Do people who are remote, who are interacting remotely, who are coordinating remotely, realize the outcomes of their actions as much as, say, the people who are on the ground, the people in situ?
I think it depends on the situation, and It's actually quite hard for me to say, because we're looking at a broad spectrum of activities. When I participate in our online chats on IRC, we have an IRC channel on the Indie Media IRC server. I see the same kind of passion, the same kind of interest, but also the same kind of confusion and conflict that I see on the ground. I think the emotional investment is very much comparable. And what we haven't quite figured out yet is how to make use of this IRC channel and other online communities in ways that are as visible to the public, maybe. At the moment, you could compare them to stagehands, but I think in their potential, they're incredibly powerful, especially when it comes to establishing a culture.
And finally, documentation is an extremely important part of your technology agenda, and I know that you are systematically documenting what it is that you're doing. Are you creating a new anarchist cookbook?
We're not going to teach people how to build bombs. We don't build bombs. What we want to do is teach people how to build organizations. I think what we are seeing here is only an early predecessor of 21st century protest movements. And it's very much apparent on the ground that we have many questions. A lot of the people participating don't have a history in political activism. On one hand. On the other hand, we're setting up organizational structure that many people aren't familiar with. So being able to describe what it is that you learned ends up being quite important. And when I think about what does the Occupy movement accomplish, or what will it have accomplished in the end, to me, one big aspect is definitely this, the accumulation of knowledge of how to build these kinds of structures, documenting design patterns that allow other people to adopt such a model to their situation. And I think it's quite important that we do that.
There is so much that has come before with regards to this, with building online communities. I mean, this is stuff that's been going on since, you can argue since DARPANET, you know, because you had communities of academics, you had distributed communities of academics who were trying to do things, coordinate, communicate. So it's not as if this is something new. And in many ways, the spotlight is on you right now for doing this. How is this in any way different from other things that have happened before?
There are a couple of ways in which I think it's quite new, but maybe the core of it is the fact that we are not making the default assumption to organize in hierarchies. In the tech team specifically, it is the question of how to empower the individual to work on things that they know about and that they can do quickly without losing the wisdom of the team and the crowd around them, of the group around them. It's a very interesting tension. How do you empower the individual but make use of the wisdom of a group in a situation that is not hierarchical? To me, it is not obvious how to resolve that tension.
Well, many experiments have failed, you know, in the past. What have you learned from looking at previous online community dynamics, networks that you are in many ways correcting in your strategy and what you're doing now?
I want to give you another example. It doesn't relate to online communities, but it relates to communication structure. I had a conversation with someone who wrote UN disaster aid manuals, and he pointed out that the first thing those missions would set up is a coordination team. At the moment, the Occupy movement, or at least in London, does not have a central organization or coordination team. We're figuring out how to make one, but the concern from many sides is that there is a risk of turning it into a management structure, which it shouldn't be. So in regards to your question, I don't think we have the answer you're looking for. I think at the moment we're trying to find out those answers. From the outside, it might look like we're slow and we're not giving the right answers quickly enough. But I also want to point out that I think, as I said earlier, this is a time of deep structural change. We're looking at very hard questions and very broad questions. And I think this is only the beginning. Many of the answers that we're looking for now in this particular situation, we'll have for a long time. And I'm not impatient when it comes to that. I have a lot of time. I think we'll work on these problems for quite a while, but I think it'll be worth finding answers.
Well, you can find out more on occupywiki.org.uk. And if you have been involved with an online community before and have experienced some of these issues, then I'm sure they would love to hear from you. Or if indeed you've come up against your own problems in the past that you feel that they're not coping with very well, then you can find out at occupywiki.org.uk. That's it for this week. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks as well to Juliet Garside and Martin Dittius for joining me in the studio. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer this week was Scott Colley. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.